Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Wednesday, March 18th. We're going to start with our work session on House Bill 2645. We have an amendment. And Brian, if you could bring us up to speed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2645A. Universities to consult with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to establish priority enrollment for qualified first-time veterans or active service members, remove the requirement of proof of residency and time limit to apply, removes ODVA certification. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and it has passed through the House Vets Committee with a 6-1.
And we have -4 amendments, is that correct? If you could describe those too, that'd be great.
The -4 amendments combine the -A2 and -A3 proposals, which respectively provide for new student orientation requirements and exempt community colleges that do not have existing priority registration.
Okay. So this fits with the description that we heard from Jock Mills about the process that they use at Oregon State to require a consultation to help make sure that people are taking the courses that are in line with their intended path. At least that's my recollection. Any other comments on that bill before we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, would the university like to, or the representative from universities like to say they concur with it now? Or
I think we've, Jock, would you like to let us know? A nod is probably significant. sufficient. Okay, we get the thumbs up.
Thank you.
Is that okay for you, Representative?
Yes, sir.
Very
Thank
good.
You.
Representative Gallegos.
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated March 11, 2015.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved the -4 amendments to House Bill 2645. Representative Johnson, this is the bill on priority registration. We just got a thumbs up from Oregon State as to their approval of this concept. So we're now going to vote on the -4 amendments for 2645. Is there any discussion?
Did we hear from all other six universities?
Well, when Mr. Mills was before us before, I think he said he was speaking for the other universities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Coming for.
Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the -4 amendments are adopted. Representative Gallegos.
Let's see. Chair Reed, I move that House Bill 2645A as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved House Bill 2645A as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. We have the revenue and fiscal impact statements, as Brian mentioned, so this bill is ready to go. Any discussion on the bill? The motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2645 is headed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Since it's Representative Witt's bill, we'll ask him to carry. Close the work session on House Bill 2645. And let's see. We're next going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2670. All right.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, House Bill 2670. Allows in-state tuition in certain circumstances for individuals who resided in Oregon but relocated due to position in military, government, or humanitarian aid organization. Declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact with no statement yet issued.
Good. Thank you. We are going to hear from Representative Buckley in a bit, and I think Victoria is bringing up the sign-up sheets for the other folks. So stand by for a moment. So I think what we'll do is leave the hearing open on House Bill 2670, and when Representative Buckley arrives, we'll come back to it. In the meantime, let's move on to House Bill 3390 and open a public hearing on that. If you could give us a summary on that, Representative Evans, if you'd like to join us, and we'll hear from you too. Brian.
Chair Reed, members of the committee. House Bill 3390 directs the Department of Corrections to enter into an interagency agreement with community college and public university for purpose of establishing a program that provides post-secondary education to inmates. Sunsets program on June 30th, 2019, declares an emergency effective on July 1st, 2015. no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, no statement yet issued, and there is a subsequent referral to Judiciary Committee.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Evans.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm a state representative for House District 20, the prettiest district, at least I say it's the prettiest district, including Independence, Monmouth, parts of West Salem and South Salem. I'm here talking about House Bill 3390. I'm going to be very brief because we have a panel that actually knows the program a whole lot better than I do. But the to tee it up, I have the privilege, great privilege, of teaching at a community college. And after 20 years in the military, on and off, and many of us talk about a lot of those different things, I have a chance to work with adults that are trying to find their way in a very complicated world, sometimes returning students. And somebody, and I can't remember who it was, described adult education as the first church of second chances. That's why this bill, to me, is critical. It represents a program that has been working for some time because of actually volunteers putting money in. It's currently going on because of grant money, but it's something that is a program that I believe is worth our time as a pilot program to look at. It's something that, in terms of educating folks that are incarcerated, it's something that the state used to do a lot of back in the 80s and 90s before we decided that we wanted to not do that anymore because of financial purposes. But it's something that actually has dramatic recidivism rates, and it has a huge impact upon the individuals that go back into society and do something positive with their lives. So I'm going to stop there. I'm going to ask for your interest and support and participation involved with this bill. I'm going to let the experts get up here and testify, if that's okay.
Thank you, Representative Evans. Before you leave, we should ask if there are any questions for you. I don't see any.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we have four people on our list. I'll just, I think we have three, well, one person already here. So we may need one more chair if you want to be all together, or we could do two and two. The four people are Michelle Deshaun McCormick, Nancy Green, Thomas Curtis, and Heidi Stewart. Do you want to all go together? Do you want to go two and two?
Let's go two and two.
Okay.
Perfect.
Please.
Chair Reed, we have actually one other student that we probably forgot to have sign in.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Yes, I'll ask when we're finished with the four if there's anyone else who wants to testify. Please go ahead.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Green, Shemeketa Community College, the Executive Director of Corrections Education, and I also have the privilege of being the Education Manager in the Salem Area Prisons. Thank you to the committee for your time. I have one of our teachers and two of our students here to talk about an important life-changing program that we're currently doing. We call it College Inside. We are here in this room because we have quite a few people in this room that have either personally attended our College Inside program or who have taught or are supporters. And I would like them to raise their hands, if that's okay.
Oh. Large group.
So we have a good representation. This number would certainly be higher if it weren't finals weeks. We have quite a few folks that are taking finals at the universities and teachers that are actively involved in giving those finals. So today I want to talk to you about how prison education works to keep our community safer and stronger, how Shemeketa College Inside program works, and how we are uniquely positioned to offer the program detailed in House Bill 3390. My first point is that we know locking people up and throwing the key away doesn't work. But even if you think this is the way things should happen, I want you to think of another fact. 95% of the people currently incarcerated are going to get out of prison. They will be our neighbors, our coworkers, parents at our children's schools. The College Inside program helps with the transition back into the world. We know that while the recidivism rate in Oregon is about 26.5%, we have had just 6 of our graduates return to prison. Because only about half of those 127 graduates have been released so far, this gives us a recidivism rate of 9.3%. This is about one-third of Oregon's recidivism rate, and it's a fact that we're proud of. But don't just take our word for the value of education while incarcerated. A 2013 RAND Corporation study found that being involved in a prison education program reduces someone's likelihood to come back to prison by 43%. The study found that nothing else has this significant of an impact on someone's likelihood to reoffend. We know that our graduates will face barriers to employment, housing, and other things when they get released from prison. But we also know that education gives them important items in their toolkits to help them stay on the right path. We know that beyond learning math, writing, or communication, our students also learn empathy, critical thinking skills, and other things that will help them find paths to better futures for themselves and for their families. When they stay on the right path, as more than 90% of them have, it makes our community safer. It means fewer future victims. It also means that they have the ability to be paying taxes rather than being a burden on taxpayers. My second point is to tell you about our program. We're very proud of our students and their accomplishments, and several of them are here with us today. You can see an information sheet in your folder if you want to look more. And it talks about the 417 students that we've served beginning since 2007 and that we've had 127 graduates. It's also encouraging for me to be able to report that 76.6% of our release graduates are working or going to school. We're funded currently entirely through private donations. As with many nonprofit programs, funding comes and goes. We were fortunate to start the program because of a generous citizen here in our community who funded the program from 2007 to 2013. When the funding ended, we scrambled to find another funding source. The Sunshine Lady Foundation responded to our request for emergency funding for the 2014-15 and the 2015-16 school years. While we are hopeful they will continue to fund the program, we have no guarantee. We're very lucky to have tremendous support from other local community members as well as staff and students who donate regularly to the program. But we still have no guarantee of the existence of the program until after next June. I believe we have much to offer the community and the state. For example, with a completion rate of nearly 80%, we certainly help achieve the 40-40-20 goals set up for education in Oregon. The completion rate is higher than many other colleges' completion rates, especially for two-year colleges. My third point is to tell you about how we are uniquely positioned to continue doing what we do best. With our current robust associate's degree program at the Oregon State Penitentiary and Sandy M. Correctional Institution, the good relationships we have with administrators at these locations, the busy classrooms, the computer labs, the study halls, experienced teachers, and over $50,000 donated in textbooks by the publishers from across the country to keep our costs low, we are already providing an important service. The only piece we don't have is sustainable funding, and this bill would provide that for us. We would welcome working with all of you and the Department of Corrections to have that happen. And in closing, I would like you to think about the worst thing you've ever done in your life and how you would not want to be defined by that for the rest of your life. So with Chemeketa's College Inside program, we would rather have our students known for being college graduates, moving on to better futures, and becoming successful taxpaying citizens. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much. Please go ahead.
The United States prisons and jails at 5,000 plus.
I'm sorry to interrupt. If you could start by introducing yourself
for
the record, that'd be
great.
That's
right.
Thanks.
My name is Michelle Deshaun McCormack, I live here in Salem, and I am a professor at Chemeketa Community College.
Thanks.
Sure. The United States has more prisons and jails at 5,000 plus than we have colleges and universities. As a college professor, someone who's been teaching for 20 years in colleges and universities, this statistic is very, it's shocking when you look at it on paper. And the best teaching that I've gotten to do is for the last 7 years for the College Inside program inside two Salem prisons. And so that's why I'm here to talk to you today briefly about that. So I teach classes for the associate's degree, and they're the same classes that I teach on the Salem campus on Lancaster Drive that I teach at the Oregon State Penitentiary and at other prisons. And it is the students that I have in these programs are the best students that I've had. They're the hardest working. The first class that I taught at the Oregon State Penitentiary, I walked in the room, and I was a little nervous, and the students were a little nervous. And one of the students raised his hand, and he said, Ms. McCormack, we've read the first four chapters of the book, so what should we do now? And I said, well, we're going to go home, because that's not really what usually happens with students haven't read half of the book before the class starts, usually on the Salem campus of Chemeketa. But it's just indicative of how hard these students work, the work ethic that they have. They're the highest grades I post all the time, and that is just consistently. I've taught a lot of classes in prison and a lot of classes at private universities and public schools, and they're the best students that I have. So it's very exciting to me. The GPA for these students, it varies from term to term, but it has often been as high as 3.9 on a 4.0 scale. So it shows you how hard these students are working, and many of them have not been in school for many years. Some of them have dropped out of school when they're in seventh grade. So when you hear the stories and you look at the totality of that, it's really powerful. And once our students are released, they go on to four-year schools. We have at least two students who are in the Portland State University Honors College. We have at least one student working on a master's degree. We have a student who's an ambassador for new students at the Portland State University Engineering School. I mean, the list, I could go on and on, but I won't because I know our time is short. But the list of the accomplishments that these students have achieved and continue to achieve for themselves, their families, and their communities is quite remarkable. I attended a meeting with University of Oregon professors and students Sunday night at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I told them that that Representative Evans had asked me to come and talk about this program, and they were very excited. Some of their loved ones and networks are sitting here in the audience with us today. And the next night I walked in to teach a communication class. Less than 24 hours later, I walked into the prison, and students from seven of the inmate clubs, the Veterans Club, the Latino Club, a Narcotics Anonymous group, a lot of clubs, they gave me letters of support to show how much they support this program and how important they think that educational programs are in prison. The other thing that I want you to know is that the students pay $30 a class, so they are not sitting there asking for a free ride. And $30 to some of these students is, if you add a book on top of that, can be a month or 2 months of wages. So it's important to note that the students are not, the students are contributing. And when we lost our major donor, our major private donor, the students came to Nancy and I and said, you know, what can we do to help? And there's a group of them, I'm learning alongside of them how to write grants, because I've never done it, but we're learning together because they don't want to see this program go away, and they're willing to fight for it. And I will just wrap up with a story that one of the students has wrote in his letter of support for this program. And this is a student who has shared with me that he could not write when he came to prison when he was 20 years old. And when he told me this, I didn't believe him, because he writes these, you know, graduate level papers in my 100 level communication classes. And he's got a 3.9 GPA. He's set to get his associate's degree in business from Chemeketa next summer. But he told me how proud he is. I mean, I think this story represents the ripple effect that this program has on people's families. And he talked about how he was so proud of his son. His son, he had really pushed and pushed and pushed his son to go to school, and his son didn't want to. But he finally talked him into it. And he wrote that that he was most proud of that, of the impact that this has had on his son. And I just want to read his quote. His son is now in his third term at Portland Community College. And he writes, "The statistics say that my son should be joining me here in prison, but college inside beats the statistics. And Francisco is right. We are beating the statistics. This program is a good investment for our communities." And I had the privilege to hear Jennifer Williamson speak actually at the sponsors fundraising gala last fall. And she said a lot of things that were really powerful to me about investing in education and strengthening families and things that I believe we're doing with this program. So I think this program is a good investment, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Ms. Green or Ms. McCormick? Representative Newman.
So thanks for your presentation, both of you. So I appreciate that. There's a part of me, I'm inspired by when you say that the grade point averages are really high, that means that they are getting into it and everything. But there's a part of me that says we have so many demands for our money and for our resources, and I say, to use it on prisoners seems like maybe they shouldn't go to the front of the line or something like that. And then I say, you should probably shouldn't say that in committee. What about developing online education and having that be the answer? And that's something that could be available to everybody. Do you use that? And have you thought about that as a resource for this?
Either one. Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, it's a great question, and I understand your other feelings of what other community members might say and other citizens of our state. When we talk about internet access, we currently do not have that in the prison. There's a lot of reasons. We're pushing, hopefully, for some type of a lockdown internet system so that we can have the access to do some online. And looking at our students and working with them, I don't think every student is an online student. I think they need the access or face-to-face with the teacher. They need the I know personally when I've done online classes, it takes me twice as long. I prefer a face-to-face class with the teacher, but I think it's really something that is also something we're working on with hoping to propose to the Governor's Reentry Council and see that move forward. On the other piece, if it's okay that I answer, I think if we talk about the cost of incarceration, it's something like $86 or $87 a day, and the cost of how much education reduces recidivism, I think if we just look at the dollar savings to the state, it's massive. And I do have those numbers not with me at the moment, but if anyone would like to look at those, I'd be happy to share those.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Williamson.
Can I just add something to that for Representative Nierman? The story of Francisco, your student, was fantastic. And I think the other thing we have to recognize when we talk about investing in folks who are incarcerated, I know for women it's 75% to 80% of them are moms. And so you're not just investing in that person at that time, but in a family, and allowing someone to come out and get a job and to have a leg up on not reoffending actually has an impact on a lot more people than just the person who's incarcerated. So the ripple effect of these kinds of programs is really tremendous.
Thanks, Representative Williams. Representative Hayden?
Chair Reed, I have three questions. I could do them as follow-up or all together, but my first question would be, why a four-year sunset? These types of programs, typically we like to see some studies on them. It seems like a bit tight of a time containment to try and get the program developed and going and then get information back on the success or failures or tweaking of the program. So why 4 years?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, I wasn't involved in the writing of the bill, so I don't know all the history on that. There you go. I can say currently it takes our students about 3 years to complete their associate's degree because they're working full-time in prison. Mm-hmm. And then with the constraints of it's count time and the times they need to be in their cells and be, you know, it's a very rigorous schedule that they have inside, that it does take us about 3 years to complete complete the program. But I think we can also then draw on the statistics that we've got from College Inside since 2007. And nationally, in the RAND study, they've done similar studies on programs, and they give some good statistics on what works. And I think for us, we've been able to prove that since 2007, our first graduates were in 2009. They were some that had some college credits. So we're tracking everyone very closely to make sure that we have stats to share to prove that education does make a difference.
Go ahead, Representative.
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, if I could. Again, my name is Paul Evans, Representative House District 20. I'm the one to blame on some of this stuff, so I'll take it. Number one, we wrote a bill that's very flexible, and I to answer your first question, the 4 years is because, number one, the program's actually already up and running in many ways. We wanted to be able to come back in a reasonable amount of time to show an apples-to-apples comparison on recidivism, because sometimes, depending on different programs and other inputs, we just wanted to make sure that it was a clear study. If you wanted to go longer, I'm way
open. It just seems tight to me. But
I agree. It was kind of in legislative council. It was, what is the smallest amount in terms of cost we could do and still have some type of study? If you want to go longer, I'm, again, very open to that type of study, because I think this will bear itself out.
I think, Representative Hayden, the without jumping to the end of the hearing prematurely, I suspect that many of us will think this a worthy program, and like so many other things, our challenge is going to be a financial one. So,
follow up for Representative Evans. You mentioned in your presentation that there was a pilot project. Which universities or community colleges would be excluded, and which would be included?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, again, because of cost, because of all the infrastructure that's already been put in place by Chemeketa running this program through grants, to keep it simple and short and as little in cost as possible, we're trying to keep it localized to the two facilities that already have a relationship, Chemeketa being the community college for the pilot, and then Western Oregon because of a historical relationship between Western and the same two institutions, and their interest, also talking to them offline. Long term, I want every community college and every university in it, but we're trying to have a very small cost and very small window to be able to come back to you with proven results in DOC to DOC comparisons with the folks that already have those relationships to try to minimize the cost.
One more follow-up question. Yep. Sorry for taking so much time. Okay, so if the House approved, or if Bill 2973, which is the requirement of universities to come up with a bachelorette or a bachelor degree for $10,000 or less, and to come up with two of those degrees, would there be a possibility, if that became effective, to use that as an avenue to start the population that we're trying to serve here in the pilot project to step into a $10,000 degree, so you actually have some cost containment with a goal objective, and if that did become an opportunity for them, they would actually have a focus to transition from maybe their first year or 2 years or 3 years in a four-year degree, then they know where they're going to go to finish it.
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, at the risk of speaking for agencies that I'm certain have their own opinions about it, I think that I would be willing to work in a work group with this bill as a vehicle, with any other pieces of legislation that are out there, to find a way to fund the program and do it in a way that is consistent with other focuses around the state. Again, this is a vehicle that is a draft vehicle to start the conversation, to try to save a program that has results through a pilot program, but I am open to almost anything in terms of finding other ways to resource it and expand the program once it, again, demonstrates itself to the satisfaction of the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you very much. You probably answered my question already, but I just, because you mentioned the grant writing as one of your processes, so I'm assuming there'll be interest in finding some sort of match to this with regard to the state money as well as...
Please.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, specifically, the bill was actually written as an incentive. The reason you see the two numbers, 150 and 300, again, those can be negotiated. But the goal was to create a baseline program that would actually be scalable if we could find more grants and more benefactors to be involved in the process. So it's actually written specifically as an incentive for private public partnerships. That's what it's designed to do.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. As I mentioned at the beginning, we opened a public hearing on House Bill 2670. Representative Buckley has joined us, so excuse you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Buckley has been patiently waiting. I didn't want to interrupt the conversation here. So we're going to go back to 2670 while Representative Buckley is here, and then we'll come back to finish our testimony on House Bill 3390. Yeah. Representative Buckley, thanks for your patience. We've heard a summary of the bill a few minutes ago, but we're eager to hear from you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. I appreciate having a chance to listen to the conversation on College Inside. It's a fascinating program. Very intrigued by it. House Bill 2670 came about just from an email correspondence I had with a family that they had been in Oregon for many years. They were raising their kids in Oregon, but they decided both to enlist. And several years back. When they enlisted in the military, they were required to move out of state. In their minds, they've always considered themselves Oregonians, and their kids want to go to school, go to college in Oregon. And they were asking simply, since the reason that they left the state was to serve our country, could their kids still maintain in-state tuition status as Oregonians? They planned to return to Oregon after their military careers, and it seemed to me to be a fair thing to do. We contacted the University of Oregon, where they were interested, their kids were interested in going. The University of Oregon was open to working with this idea, but there really wasn't anything in statute that talked about providing in-state tuition for the children of military families. The bill's been expanded slightly to include families that might go into the Peace Corps or other type of organizations that, again, are service organizations. And the basic idea is, if an Oregon family decides to commit themselves to service, can we still maintain in-state tuition status for their kids, even though their service obligation takes them out of state? And that's it. Pretty simple, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. Are there questions? Representative Gallegos.
Representative, do you have any idea of numbers we're talking about?
You know, we don't. Chair Reed and Vice Chair Gallegos, we don't. I'm assuming it's not much, and I'm assuming if we get a fiscal, we'll get some kind of rough estimate. But we're talking about a handful of families that have found themselves in this situation.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Buckley, it looks to me like international position with the state, federal government, or humanitarian aid organization is a new addition to this. Is this a new thing? Or, I mean...
Representative Nierman, yes. This was actually added at the request of some folks who hadn't worked in the Peace Corps, and they said, well, we would have loved this, when we were bringing up our kids, and we would love this if this was available to our kids, previously. So we did add that to the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Questions? Let's see. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for
your patience. Representative Buckley was the only person who signed up on House Bill 2670. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on that bill while we have the hearing open? I don't see anyone. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2670. We are still open on House Bill 3390, so we'll resume our testimony there. Thomas Curtis and Heidi Stewart are the other two people who have signed up. Someone mentioned a student who had signed up. I don't have that one in front of me, but was it you, sir? Please come forward. I'll let you decide the sequence. We're eager to hear from you. Please begin by introducing yourself for our record.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Stewart. I'm the Assistant Director with the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I'm here today to provide information regarding House Bill 3390. Philosophically, the Department of Corrections agrees with the intent of this piece of legislation. We know that education programs have a significant impact on recidivism. As a matter of fact, there is a 2013 study published by the RAND Corporation that found that those participating in education programs have a 43% chance lower risk of recidivating than those that do not participate in education programs. As you heard earlier during testimony, the Department of Corrections currently offers associate degree programs. Two different community colleges offer those programs, Chemeketa Community College and Blue Mountain Community College. And those programs, as mentioned, are funded through grants, donations, and inmate self-pay. Our concerns with the bill are generally related to cost and required participation numbers, although we do have one additional concern, and that is that the bill limits inmate participation for 3 years, which in turn only allows them to achieve an associate's degree. General fund biennial appropriation that is included in this bill appears to fund 37.5 separate individuals per year for a total of 150 inmates at the end of the 17-19 biennium.
which is the minimum number required by the bill. However, the bill also requires DOC to pay the cost for an inmate to participate in post-secondary program for multiple years, if so desired by the inmate, for up to 3 years. If multiple inmates participate in the program for more than 1 year, the potential exists for DOC to fall short of serving the required number of inmates or be placed in a position to supplement the cost in order to meet the requirements of the bill. And unfortunately, we just don't have those dollars in our education budget today. We are consistently experiencing space issues within our institutions to offer programs. So if this legislation passes, we just ask for ample time to be able to overcome those barriers and figure out how we're going to deliver these programs, if they are indeed classroom programs. If the intent is to offer these programs online, we do have some technology concerns and infrastructure concerns that we'd have to overcome as well. And obviously, there is a financial impact with that. And lastly, the bill would increase the need for inmates to access computers as well as the internet to complete class assignments. Today, the existing computer labs within our institutions are at capacity with the adult basic skills development program that we have running. Inmates do not have internet access today, and that is for security and infrastructure reasons. Again, we can overcome that barrier, but it will take ample time to plan and cost to overcome that. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I think I'd like to hear from the panel, and then we'll take questions. Mr. Curtis? If you can move the microphone over to you, in front of you, that'd be great. You don't have to be very close to it, however.
Okay.
It'll pick up very well.
Yeah, right.
That's
perfect.
Perfect.
Chair,
perfect.
Members of the committee, first of all, I'm very nervous. My name is Thomas Curtis, for the record. It's an honor to be here in front of you today. I was in prison for 11 years, 1 month, and I definitely deserved every day. excuse me. And in there, I wasted a lot of time, tons of time, time I wish I could get back. I watched a lot of daytime television, which is almost the epitome of wasting time. one thing that I did that did not waste time and really set me up for my future was this College Inside program. And here I am getting emotional. And
it was a
great program. And everyone that I know that's been a part of it has had, you know, a positive impact on their life. I feel like it's very cost effective. I feel like yesterday I took a final for Compilers 2, which was the last class of the computer science program. So hopefully, barring a terrible grade in that class, I should graduate with a degree in computer science. And if I hadn't had 2 years, 2.5 years of the College Inside program, I don't think that I would have gotten out after 11 years, 1 month, and been prepared to study, prepared to time manage, prepared to work with other students in group projects. And that's something that the College Inside program, they taught me, and the teachers taught me, and there's a support network now of guys that have gotten out and are a part of this program. So people that I was fortunate enough to have family support, but some people that don't for one reason or another, they've since gotten out, and they have this support network of guys that have gone to college like me and Travis, and we're able to kind of support each other and help each other with the ropes. So I do think that, you know, of all the programs that the prison provides, this is one where you really are building something for your future, and it's tangible. It's not just a certificate from something. It's real. It could be a degree. It could be something that goes on to for a four-year degree. Anyway, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. You did not need to be nervous. You were very effective.
No, thank you.
Travis, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'm nervous as well. First, I would like to address...
I'm sorry to interrupt. If you could start with your name, that would be
My name is Travis Graham. I'm from Eugene.
Thank you.
First, I would like to address Representative Williamson and what she said. She hit it on the head. This isn't just about prisoners. This is about the community and the people that are left behind when inmates get incarcerated. And my testimony today is living proof of that. I'm a father of three kids, and when I got incarcerated in 2007, that's who was affected. And I appreciate that very much, Ms. Williamson. I've wrote a whole bunch of stuff out here, and I'll probably lose it because I'm going to go to a deep place here, and I'm going to expose myself. I'm not very good at exposing myself, but I'm doing this for the community that I hurt, my loved ones. So I'm going to try to keep going here. If I break out in tears or whatever, I this is for a good cause, and I believe
Thank
in this.
You.
And so I'm going to hold up three boards here, and they all have one word on them. I want each one of you to read these.
There you go. Thanks.
And as you read these, silently to yourself, just think about what they do for yourself. And when you read these, you should feel fortunate, because you're 90% of them Oregonians that have had an education. There's 10% of Oregonians that don't know how to read. And when I went to prison, I'd never met an individual that didn't know how to read. I always considered my childhood, I was fortunate. I grew up with, you know, two parents, had everything I needed. And bad choices as a young adult, lack of education, lack of critical thinking, the things I didn't have because I jumped out and went into the workforce right out of high school, because the loved ones that were directly around me didn't believe that I had the education or the intelligence to get an education. My own family encouraged, I wanted to go to college. Become design golf courses right out of high school, but I was told I didn't have the intelligence for my own. I got incarcerated, and I was in a bad spot. And everybody asks, "What happened?" This word right here is the most important word to me. It's a very simple word. I met a kid. I was a tutor in. A GED ABE tutor in prison, OSCI, for 3 years. And I met an individual that came into the program. He was a 20-year-old kid from Linn County, grew up there his whole life. And he said he had a learning disability. So I sat down and ran the typical test that we do every student that comes in, and they read to us and do their math. And the kid opened the book, and he got stuck on the. And I thought he was kidding me. And he kept trying to pronounce it, and he knew it was a T, and he kept saying, "Tee." And I thought he was kidding me. But come to find out, this kid had made it to a senior year in Linn County and couldn't say the alphabet. He got to L, and that's far as he could get. And "Tee." And the kid, all of a sudden I seen it come across his body, all the barriers broke down, and he says, "All I want to do is these 2 years is learn how to read, for when I go home, I can read to my daughter." He'd never read to her before. And at that moment is when I realized what that punishment was handed down. It wasn't a punishment. It was an opportunity for me to learn. And that's what comes through education. And to think that they're just inmates or prisoners, you're right. And that's why they're in prison, is to serve their time. But to take that education away from any human being is not American. Education is a gift that never taken away, and it takes you through the different social classes and takes you out of ignorance. Mm-hmm. And if we can have programs like this one that has saved my life, has changed my life, and has opened up opportunities for me and my family and the community, this is what lowers recidivism. This is what changes the cycle of families going to prison. I can look at my 11-year-old boy 3 years ago. He hated school. Now I have full custody of two of my boys. My 18-year-old daughter lives in Nevada getting ready to go to school. And my oldest boy is looking for college now because he sees his dad going to University of Oregon. I graduated in prison with two associate's degrees. Upon my release in 2013, I entered into University of Oregon. I've got five more classes, and I'm going to double major in business and environmental sociology. It's not about getting over on anybody. My goal, long term, is to give back to the community. My goal is to work on river restoration and to make the things that humans that have destroyed to make our community better and to bring values into things that I learned in prison. And that wasn't because of uniforms. This wasn't because of razor wire. This wasn't because of prison programs. This wasn't because of officers. This was because of a man that I know as the donor saw good and opportunity in making change in individuals that are broken. For you guys that looked around and see these words, we see that 90% of Oregonians can read. Look at what the prison population is for illiteracy. That'll alarm you. If anything, just give them the opportunity to change, because we're not asking for everybody. You're never going to get everybody in prison to change. Nobody. There's a lot of people that don't want to change. There's a few people. It's not cool to be in there and change. It's hard to let them barriers down around 1,000 men that want to be hard and say, I want to change. I want to be that person for my kids. I want to be that person for my community. I want to give back. And that's hard to face 1,000 men that are angry. And that's all I ask, Mr. Chair, is to give the opportunity to those. Be the teacher, and the students will come. That's all we're asking. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Graham. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Reed. So I have a question for the Department of Corrections in line 28. It looks like there's $712,500 allocated to the program, and then it refers back to Section 1, which refers to having to provide up to $9,500 per year per inmate up to a total of 3 years. Within that funding scheme, it seems plausible, or at least not excluded, for you to use some of that funding for the computer upgrades. Do you read this that all of those funds have to go directly to the community college, or is there part of that funding for your own infrastructure?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, the way that I read that is I haven't given consideration to that. I was simply looking at the numbers of serving 150 to 300,000, and that appropriation already isn't enough to serve that number. So I don't see how I can serve that number and upgrade the computer classrooms.
Yeah, I did. I ran those numbers too. So, follow up?
Yes, please.
So if we had an opportunity to get in a capped rate degree situation, would that be something that would be more tenable for you to say, okay, we're going to have $10,000 degree access versus $9,500 per year per inmate, so they can keep track and then lower the cost significantly of the portion going to the community college, but then keep some of the funds available for your infrastructure to upgrade?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, absolutely. We're willing to, we absolutely support post-secondary education. We'd love to see more programs within our institutions. I just have to have funding that goes along with that because my current budget doesn't support it.
Okay. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. This is just opening up so many questions in my mind. But first, I want to thank you gentlemen for coming and speaking to us today. I think we all recognize how difficult it is to come before our committees, and you did a wonderful job of telling your stories, and we greatly appreciate your willingness to come here and talk to us. I'm having all kinds of questions, and I'm not sure they're questions for you, ma'am, with the Department of Corrections. They may be for the bill drafter, and I don't know if Representative Evans is still here.
Still here, yeah.
It seems to me, from what I'm hearing, that there's really not a question as to whether that these programs are successful and that they impact recidivism rates. So I'm wondering if we need another, in essence, pilot program to determine that. I think statistics probably nationwide have determined that these programs are very successful. And I see that there's a priority given to programs that are already in place or have been in place for 5 years. I guess my question would be, has there thought been given to a different structure here where
all of those county jails where we have people incarcerated for fairly lengthy periods of time, and corrections facilities across the state could have an opportunity to participate. Where it, here, it looks like it's pretty well set that it's going to be the programs that are already there. So we know it works. Do we need a pilot, or is there a way to just expand this program because we know it's already successful?
Questions? Representative Evans.
Chair Reed, Representative McEwen. I'm up for full funding without a pilot program.
I know that opens a whole different door.
the reason we wanted to do it is there over the last several months, as we were trying to find other alternatives, and for the folks, Nancy and Michelle, who have done yeoman's work trying to keep the program alive over the last several years, we've just tried to find different ways to provide not just a state-funded answer, but a mechanism that would actually inspire private-public contribution and partnership as well, because, again, this program has been supported by a private donor for most of its existence. Again, with very few exceptions, I'm up for anything that will keep programs like this alive. We tried to keep it simple because the infrastructure at Chemeketa and inside the institutions are already there right now. The relationships are there right now. And there would be some, probably minimal, but nonetheless, in today's climate, some additional cost for the community colleges and universities that aren't currently doing this. And with respect to the community college in God's country on the east side of the mountains, I'd be up for including that as well, except for, again, keeping it closer to Salem just because those systems are in place. So I see another question coming, so I'll shut up.
Perhaps we should have asked your question when Representative Buckley was here.
That would have been appropriate.
Follow-up,
Reed, I do have a follow-up. And my follow-up is for you two gentlemen. We're providing services in, the inside piece. How are you funding your educations outside at the University of Oregon? And I'm assuming, sir, and where would your degree be from?
Portland State.
Portland State. So now that you're on campus, how are you funding your educations?
Okay.
Do you mind my asking? Is that too personal a question?
No, I myself, before I released, I had all my financial aid packet through the federal government, and Oregon has some financial aid. I had that arranged, so I had financial aid set up. I had everything arranged for the school, and that's what I've been riding on is scholarships and student loans while I've been out.
What a tremendous resource you will be to your children, knowing how to navigate that complex system. You're my hero of the day.
Mine is the same as well.
Same thing.
A mix of scholarships, the federal Pell Grant, and then student loans.
So when you were coming out of your incarceration, did someone help you learn how to navigate that system as part of that program?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know if she's here, but Betsy Simpkins.
Great.
And
I'm
Nancy
just delighted
Green.
To hear that, because that can be such a tremendous hurdle. So.
Yeah, okay. They were fantastic.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Let me go to Representative Williamson, then come back to Representative Higgins, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually wanted to speak a bit to the first question that Representative McEwen had, putting on my Ways and Means hat. Mm-hmm. This is a budget that I work on, and we are right now having presentations from the Department of Corrections in our subcommittee. To the question about the county jails, I think the barrier there is you have 36 counties who run their jails independently, and folks don't stay there very long. And so to expand this program to county jails, I don't know how we would do it, frankly. And as for the funding of a pilot versus full funding for a program, I think we've seen nationally the disinvestment in education programs and programming generally in prisons across the country during the recession. And I think a lot of it has to do with what Representative Nierman said, which is if we are putting dollars into people to go to college, the general public can sometimes push back pretty aggressively when they can't themselves send their kids to college or access financial aid and the like because we have limited dollars there. So these were programs that were cut not only in Oregon, but across the country. And so the donor, Dick Withnell, who has been fantastic in funding a lot of those programs in our state, is the one who funded this program and who kept it alive. And so the infrastructure is there, and it's a matter of somebody picking up the tab again. And he shouldered that burden himself. And as to the computers and online learning, the cost of bringing on anything that involves the internet is a lot more complicated than I recognized when you bring it into a prison. So this is not a we buy laptops and plug them in, and you know that's that. That the kinds of programming that you need in order to have a secure line to the outside world is significant, and so it may or may not save money actually to do online learning because of the additional costs of using computers inside. So,
thank you for that, and thanks for answering my question about the about who the donor was, whether it was an individual or a foundation. Representative Evans, you had a comment?
Chair Reed, and just to follow up on the line of discussion that Representative Williamson's talking about in terms of finances, there's two clarifications. Number one, the $9,500 per student is actually the cost of a student over the three-year period, not $9,500 a year. So that's one thing. The second thing is the $9,500 is above the $8,500 that I'm told is actually the cost because of we wanted to have some overhead there to help DOC on some of the costs. We didn't know what they would be, but we wanted to put in a little bit of a buffer because we assumed that there would be extra costs. So not, I did not anticipate the full freight being paid, but it was a place to start. Given the costs and the approach that currently have been done.
So, Representative Evans, in the bill, on line 13 and 14, it says the department shall pay the community college or the public university up to $9,500 per year per inmate. Is that, can you help
That's
me?
That's one of the technical fixes that we need to address. And because it was going to be a financial issue, quite frankly, I was planning on working that when we got to the Ways and Means place. But yes.
Okay.
The cost is a lot different than. It's a lot less than that.
That's a very important point that may have.
That's why I want to clarify.
An impact on our ability to move to Ways and Means. So thank you for clarifying that. Let's go to Representative Hayden, then Representative Gallegos. Is that okay?
Representative Hayden, please. Thank you, Chair Reed, and thank you for that. That's kind of where I was going with the $10,000 bachelor degree.
Yes, sir.
But what are the opportunities? And this is for my education. For the people that are able to access this type of development and education that are incarcerated to have a work-study program, what are the opportunities there to share in the cost? I understand that the wages for incarcerations may not be able to cover that kind of cost, but what are the opportunities, or would there be a requirement to fill up some of that wasted time, as you mentioned, of watching daytime TV with a work-study program?
Let me break in for a moment and make one suggestion. Do we have additional questions for Mr. Graham or Mr. Curtis? If not, I think I might just excuse them, and then we can minimize the musical chairs a little bit. Is that okay? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Great.
We'll come back to Representative McEwen next. Go ahead, please.
Chair Reed, and I believe it was Representative Hayden, the students that we have in College Inside are working, and so you've talked about work study. You know, in the past, we've looked at how they can maybe do some other things to earn scholarships, maybe through the AmeriCorps or some different things like that. So those are opportunities we can certainly explore. I did want to also add to what Representative Evans said here. Right now it's costing us about $8,400 to get a student through their associate's degree program. And the students are paying, again, about $30 per class. So it even takes that cost lower. In addition, another donor I wanted to mention is Larry Tukarski here in Salem has been a huge donor to the program, as it has Dick Withnell. So we are very fortunate to have that community support from Mountain West Investments.
Thank you. Thank you. Go to Representative Gallegos and then Representative McEwen, please.
Yeah, again, I do want to thank you, gentlemen, for your testimonies. I think I have a lot of questions, but I think that I'd like to, other than the financial piece, I'd like to think about You know, we've been talking in here a lot about the last few days with regard to the HEC and about transferability, and we talk about STEM and our need to develop our workforce and so on. So I'm not actually even asking for an answer at this point, just voicing a question with regard to, you know, what curriculum opportunities do we have? Why is it just a two-year degree? Can we think about other kinds of, you know, we talk about, and we're talking to the HEC about maybe some certifications, and so I think there's all kinds of things that we could ask and think about. But thank you very much for the concept.
Thank you. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair. I have a very quick question because I don't know. Are the people who are in prison and attending, are they able to receive Pell support while they're in prison, or does that only come into effect once they leave?
Mr. Chair and Representative McEwen, the federal statute, they cannot
I'm
receive.
I'm trying to find it, and I'm not finding it.
Yeah, they're unable. What we just recently learned is there's a possibility. In fact, we've been told that our students can apply for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but we need to work very closely with our financial aid offices so to ensure that they don't also get federal financial aid. So we actually have agreed to pilot that, and we're starting with about 10 to 15 students that we will put in for the process. So they have to go through financial aid, and then I have to give a list of those students' names to our financial aid office so that they ensure that they're not getting federal financial aid.
But once they leave, then that restriction is lifted.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Reardon.
Just random question. The Workforce Investment Boards typically work with people that have fallen off the normal track and maybe haven't graduated from high school or whatever. I just wonder if there's any synergy with Workforce Investment Boards, if there's some way they might support this program or something. Beaver.
Chair Reed, Representative Reardon. Yes.
Thank you.
Right now, we're just trying to keep the program alive. Okay. Long-term, and it was one of my plans for over the interim to try to find ways to branch this out once we had a good read on whether the program was going to get to survive or not. But I think that that's a natural fit. I mean, you have literally 13,000, 14,000 folks that are a potential or will be workforce. How we can help DOC on the objectives through programs like this, I'm willing to try to bring everybody to the center, because at the end of the day, I think the state is only better, stronger, faster, more capable to compete when all hands are on deck.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've exhausted questions for you for the moment. And this completes the list of people who have signed up to testify. I recognize you brought a lot of people with you, though. We have probably just a couple more minutes before we have to move on to our other bill. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 3390? Don't see anybody, so thank you very much. I will.
Thank you.
Speaking only for myself, it seems clear that there's some additional work to do to clarify the intent and to make sure that we have an accurate representation of the financial impact. So we will await your work on that and look forward to hearing from you. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3390. And I think we're making a change at this point. Okay, great. So we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 3342. And Victoria is going to rejoin us and give us a summary. Thank you all very much for coming. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tremendous courage. Victoria, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3342 allows personal income taxpayers to subtract specified amounts paid as interest on qualified education loans from taxable income, subject to same income limitations applicable to federal education loan interest deduction. Limits qualified residents' interest deduction for personal income taxpayers. Applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2015. Takes effect on 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Thank you, Victoria. Representative Rayfield and Dan, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Dan Rayfield. I'm the state representative from House District 16, encompassing parts of Benton County, the cities of Corvallis and Philomath, and most importantly, at Oregon State University. So we're here to talk to you about House Bill 3342. In brief, it creates a new deduction for interest on student loans. And so before we get into the details of the bill, what I want to do is talk to you a little bit about the problem that this is intended to help fix. Student loan debt. What I would like you to do is kind of look up here at this graph, and what you're going to see, and the most important line is the blue line. That is inflation adjusted line, which you'll see in 1993. Folks came out of university or college with an average debt of about $15,000. Over 20 years, we're now at about $32,500, and those are for numbers in 2014. And this is a trend that continues to increase when you look at some of the trends with mortgage interest and other things. This is one that continues to rise and does not dip, depending whether we're in a recession or not in a recession. This is another interesting graph right here, and this was presented by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And what you'll see is traditionally, folks with, at age 30, folks with student debt have a higher percentage of home ownership. And the reason that has been is because you get a good job, you go out after education, you get a home. Over the last 10 years, this has actually flipped, and folks with student loan debt now have a lower percentage of home ownership at age of 30. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York essentially stated in their testimony that the growth in student loan debt, with its monthly costs, high delinquency, and default rate, is reducing household formation and home ownership. And so these are some of the problems that you end up seeing. So with a high student loan debt, you have a high overhead, number one, of what's coming out of your pocket. You're not saving for retirement. You're not saving for a rainy day. It's delaying the family formation. It's people are defaulting on loans and as a result, not buying houses. So this is what House Bill 3342 does. Currently, under federal law, there is a $2,500 deduction for the interest on student loan debt. This is capped for incomes as well, higher incomes. What House Bill 3342 does is it creates a $3,500 state deduction. This state deduction will stack on top of the $2,500 deduction. So in Oregon, should this bill pass, an individual would be able to deduct $6,000 of the interest on their student loans in a given year. So what does this do in approximately, and that's actually inaccurate, that's over 4 years. What this will do is it'll put $29 million into the pockets of folks over 4 years. This increased cash flow will increase consumer spending.
So did you say $29 million over two or over four?
4 years. Okay. 4 years. So the slide is inaccurate.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
It will. The increased cash flow will increase consumer spending. It will make increase upward mobility. It will decrease the delinquency rates on student loan debts, as well as one of the important things that we've found out in terms of businesses or folks and medical professionals, it will actually make Oregon more competitive to attract certain professions to the state, specifically in rural areas where we're not able to pay as much. So to give you a simple example, in, say, eastern Oregon or other areas where certain professions aren't making as much money, this is another way where we can say, well, what makes Oregon unique versus other states? This actually puts a little bit more money into your pocket. So this is what the funding mechanism for the home mortgage interest cap. Currently, right now, this would cost about $14.7 million $14 million in the first biennium. In the second biennium, it would cost $14.66 million. So we needed to have a funding mechanism, and based on the statistics from the Federal Reserve Bank, there was a clear nexus between home ownership and also looking at the home mortgage interest deduction.
Mr. Chair.
And what we did is, in this bill, there is a cap on the home mortgage interest deduction in the amount of $35,750.
Representative, could I interrupt for just a moment? We have a clarifying question from
Mr. Wisdom. I'm very sorry, sir, Representative. I missed the numbers of how much we're trying to offset. Can you get, because you don't have a slide on that. What are the numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. So the numbers are for the 2015-2017 biennium, according to the LRO, it's $14 million in that biennium. And that's what the interest deduction will cost. In the 17-19 biennium, it will be $14.66 million.
Thank you very much.
The And I will get to what this limits will do as well. The cap that we have in the bill is $35,750, and that's the amount of interest that a household would be able to deduct on their home mortgage in a single year. You could have multiple homes, but this is the cap that you would be stuck under. What this is equate to over there, it is essentially an $800,000 loan at 4.5% during the first year of the loan.
Or multiple loans, as you said.
Or multiple loans. And I think that's really important. What we wanted to do is cater this bill so it affects the least amount of people, but provides the maximum amount of benefit for the folks that we're trying to help. And so what we don't want to do is penalize folks who, say, have a second home for investment purposes, or say a parent who decides to buy a house in a college town like Oregon State University or down at University of Oregon. We want them to be able to take advantage of that as well. So what we've done is we've capped this, and so you could have a loan of $300,000 and a loan of $500,000. You're able to deduct all of that interest. You could have a loan of $400,000 and another loan of $400,000, able to deduct all of that interest in a given year. Go back here. So the effect of this, and Representative Wisnant, and you're probably interested in these numbers, is that in the biennium of 2015 to 2017, this will raise approximately $14.7 million. In the 2017-2019 biennium, it will raise $14.4 million, and you'll notice that it's actually decreasing as we go forward in that student loan debt is increasing. The overall revenue effect over a four-year period is a positive $500,000. We did our best to try and make this as close to revenue neutral as possible. So what's the impact on tax filers? Less than 1% of all Oregonians that apply for the home mortgage interest deduction are affected. And that's not talking about all Oregonians that file their taxes, because most Oregonians don't even file a Schedule A. So what does that look like in terms of numbers? On the left, this is how this both the cap and the deduction would affect filers who apply for these respective deductions. So on the left, you see the home mortgage interest cap. And at the very bottom, it's very difficult to see, but it's probably easier on the slides in front of you if you have them. That is the less than 1% of all tax filers that it affects. On the right is the amount of tax filers that the student deduction affects, and as you will see, it's a much more significant chunk of folks in Oregon.
So there really is a little orange line on the HMI cap stack.
It's easier to see on my iPad,
I believe.
So this is how our retooling of the home mortgage interest deduction affects Oregonians. For every one person that is affected by this deduction, we help seven people. So it's a 7-to-1 ratio. As a result of this, we've been able to get numerous supporters. We've got business groups like Oregon Business Association, student groups, Oregon Student Association. We have labor, and the medical community is actually on board with the Oregon Nurses Association, the Western University of Health Sciences, as well as, while I was sitting here, the veterinarians are now on board, and I actually got a text, and I thought I would share you what that text actually says. Our younger veterinarians are in greater need, with student loans averaging around $170,000, with starting salaries around $55,000 to $60,000. And so this is another reason for other basically broad support in the community. The folks that obviously have an interest against this would be the home builders, would be the realtors, and would also be potentially, I would imagine, the bankers as well. But again, when we look at this, it's really how do we retool what the general interest of the home mortgage interest deduction was actually for, which was to create home ownership. And this is retweaking it so we get back to that aim and use this money more efficiently. So, thank you.
Thanks, Representative Rayfield. And we do have a number of other people who are going to testify as well, but let's see if there are questions for you.
And
Yes, please.
And I actually forgot to mention that we have the Oregon Dental Association is also on board, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, and the Oregon School Employees Association. So we have logos for those.
Thank you. Representative McEwen, I just have a
clarification, and I think I misunderstood what you said back on one of your first slides. This would allow, if the student has a $500 a month student loan payment, they can't just deduct the interest portion of that. It's the entire amount of what their liability is, correct? It's their...
To a certain amount.
So, is that correct?
So there is the...
It's not the principal. It's the principal and the interest, not just the interest that the student owes on the loan.
Right. This deduction only applies to the interest. And so each year, in January, students, just like you get forms from your employer, you actually get forms from the bank stating how much interest was on your loan during that year. And then you use that number to actually use the federal deduction. So under this scenario, you would take those forms and the numbers provided on those forms from the banks that are holding those student loans and actually...
What's the annual interest that they owe on the loan that they can deduct? Got it. Thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you. Representative Rudy?
Well, thank you for bringing this forward. I know it's my own staff and other young people working in the building. It's tremendously important. Did you do some market research that might indicate the impact on the home building market? It might be an unfair question, but just curious.
Chair Reed, Representative Reardon, we did not do any of that work. We're actually in the process of looking at the economic impact that this will have in Oregon, as it does put $29 million back in the hands of a lot of Oregonians. And these are the folks who are more likely to spend that money in the communities as well.
But it does seem it would drive home building.
And
I'll suggest, Representative Reardon, that you ask that question of the home builders who we will hear from momentarily.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rayfield, thanks for all your work on this. I appreciate you coming by and talking to me about it and spending the time. I think it's obvious you've done a lot of work. I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Do grandparents that are paying for grandchildren, can they take advantage of this? That's a no.
If they have a loan,
I would imagine the loan, and that's a very good question. I would imagine the loan would actually have to be in the name of the grandparent for them to be able to take advantage of it. The way that the law is written, it's actually qualified student loans, and so I'd actually have to go back, look at the definition of what a qualified student loan is. My loans have always been in my name, so I've always been real confident that I was able to do it.
Thank you for that. I was just trying to plan my future and my grandson. You've done a lot of work for people that are a little more senior. You're assuming a low interest rate. When I bought a house in Washington, D.C. in 1980, the interest rate was 18%. So what is a significant increase due to your numbers? Have you looked at that? And did you look at instead of... tie it or you have to make that adjustment. I mean, your 1% is going to be 3 or 4% if the interest rates go up on homes.
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnant, what I would say is we actually used a conservative number when coming to this. The current mortgage rates right now are actually under 4.5%. I anticipated your question, and which is why we used the 4.5%.
Questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your work on this, too. Just a couple of clarifying questions. So as I read the bill, it just expressly points to a taxpayer, which doesn't mean that it necessarily would be a benefit. You don't have to have attended an Oregon institution, correct, to benefit for this, be paying interest on education acquired at an Oregon-based university or college, right?
Chair Reed, Representative Johnson. We tailored, in direct answer to your question, no, you could have gone to any university and be able to take advantage of this. What we did is we modeled this after the federal deduction to be as close to that as possible.
And just to follow up then, you could have attended any university in any part of the United States, moved to Oregon, and then take advantage of this. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Let's hear from the aforementioned home builders, Mr. Chandler, and realtors, Mr. Jillians. Who's first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Appreciate the dialogue this morning. This is actually an issue, rising student loan debt, that our national association has been concerned with for a couple of years now, for part of the reasons that you heard, that as you increasingly have an increased student loan debt, it's harder for you to be able to purchase a home. And as we all know, purchasing a home is one of the best ways to build wealth for the middle class, which is the entire purpose of the mortgage interest deduction, which is to incentivize people to purchase homes. And the federal government in the initial tax code saw fit to actually include the mortgage interest deduction for this very purpose, which is we wanted to incentivize home ownership. So I think we're in agreement that this is an issue that bears looking at as we look at sort of the increased cost for higher education, which I know your committee has looked at quite a bit, and the corresponding debt that goes with that. That being said, Mr. Chair, there's three lines in the bill that we do not agree with. Those are the bottom of page 2, which basically says that this larger problem caused by the increasing cost of higher education should be borne completely by homeowners. We don't share that particular view, and while I gave you a bit of a nexus of why we're concerned about rising student debt, I don't see the absolute nexus of these are the folks specifically that should be charged with paying for this particular program. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think you already heard what our objections were going to be in advance on the PowerPoint. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from Mr. Chandler, and then we may have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to this bill. Not surprisingly, I don't imagine. We do appreciate Representative Rayfield bringing us in to talk about it prior to the hearing. We also appreciate him highlighting what, as Mr. Jillians indicated, all of us in the real estate community are very worried about, which is the size of student loan debt and the impact that has on young people's ability to purchase a home or to do a lot of other things that they would otherwise be able to do with that level of debt. This committee has already talked about that in other bills and other forums. That said, I don't see the nexus that Representative Rayfield pointed to in this bill. Yes, student loan debt impedes buying a house. It also impedes buying all sorts of other stuff. But the only way the deductibility of that debt helps you in the home purchase arena is if you're already itemizing. If you're taking the standard deduction, which most people do, then increasing the amount of student loan debt you can take off doesn't help you much, and most people don't itemize their deductions until they own a home. That's the largest deduction in the tax code for the by and large. For the most part, that's the part that triggers people from moving from the standard deduction to the Schedule A's. So I think the relationship is there, but with all due respect to Representative Rayfield, I think he has it backwards. And while increasing the deductibility would help people pay a mortgage they already have, I don't know that it would help them get a mortgage in the first place until they saved up enough money from the deduction from their student loans that are now more. I don't see that. I don't think the connection is there. I do understand the attractiveness of the mortgage interest deduction as a big number. And we've been on record many times, not in this committee, but in other places, on behalf of the association, being in support of comprehensive tax reform. I hope that conversation continues this session, although we might want to get on with it since time's wasting. But until we do that bigger conversation about tax reform, we have been also steadfastly opposed to piecemeal tax reform. And some of you have heard me say this in other conversations. Doing it item line by line on the tax code is not the way to do it. Oregon's tax system is a mess. Figuring out the fact that the mortgage interest is a big number and then whittling away at it, to me, is the wrong way to approach it. Is the mortgage interest part of a tax reform conversation? Absolutely. Should it be just the shiny object that attracts people that want to pay for other programs as those programs are thought up? Absolutely not. And again, I think this is an important issue. It's a very important issue, but so is homeownership, so is making it easy for people to get homes, and frankly, the policy underlying the mortgage interest deduction ought to be kept in mind whenever you're doing anything with that, and that conversation ought to occur in that bigger discussion of tax reform. We commend the issue to you, Mr. Chairman. We do not commend this bill to you. With that, I'll conclude and take any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for either of these panels? Representative Reardon.
Thank you for coming in, Mr. Chandler. Have you forecast an impact on home building? What might occur if we had this additional injection of money into the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, other than what I just said in terms of the relationship between deductibility and purchasing, no. I don't think having people with more money in their pocket would help drive home construction, I suppose, or at least we'd be one of the expenses we'd hope they'd put money towards. But again, if they're not itemizing, they're not going to get the deduction in the first place. And that's where I climbed off of this logic, was being able to get to the Schedule A's.
So I got to interrupt there, and it's been may have been a while since you had student loan, Mr. Chandler. I'm not sure that's true. I'll have to check, but I don't think you have to itemize to deduct the interest on student loan. I think it's above the line. So we can check on that offline.
Mr. Chairman, if so, I want to file some amended tax returns.
We
might have to go back 25 years or so, but what the heck?
Yeah, exactly. Got it.
I mean, they were still keeping records ODR on a yellow pad then, so I'm sure
there's CPA in the room.
Yeah, no, I'm sure the accountants will be lined up outside for
you. No doubt.
Representative Rayfield may be able to clarify that.
Well, Mr. Chair, as someone who pays student loan interest still from law school,
yes,
it is above the line, and you're limited, as the representative pointed out, to $2,500, and then that's means tested,
right.
Which is probably why Mr. Chandler hasn't taken advantage of that.
Good point. Thank you very much. Good point. Other questions? So I have a kind of a philosophical question.
I'll back up in a second.
I understand and, of course, support your argument for the need for comprehensive tax reform. In that context, can you help us, or help me at least, understand your thinking about where, if I stipulate the idea of why the mortgage interest deduction exists, is there a point at which we could or should say the role of the public in helping incent or motivate home ownership of a certain sort of house beyond a certain level? Is there a point at which that becomes less of an important policy? I may be making this too obscure. Is it appropriate for the public to help pay the mortgage interest on really large houses, on really expensive houses? Is there a point when we say, great, you should buy that house if you want it, but the public's role in helping subsidize that should end at a certain point?
My goodness, Mr. Chair, look at the time.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think this is a conversation that's obviously been occurring at the federal level quite a bit. And sort of what wasn't mentioned, I think, in the PowerPoint is that there is a cap already on indebtedness at the federal level. It's $1 million. So the question is, and that's no matter if you have a first and second house or your first house, it's capped at $1 million.
Do you support that?
Our association thus far has supported keeping it at where it's at.
Okay.
But it has been looking at comprehensive tax reform and whether or not that's part of the broader picture. But what I'd like to sort of shift you towards, Representative, is why is specifically the mortgage interest, which already has a cap on it, why is that any more likely to go after than the charitable contribution deduction or any of the other itemized deductions that are out there? And I might add that the charitable does not have a limitation on it other than your overall income limitation. So I think when we talk about state-level comprehensive tax reform, and you and I have had this conversation before, we don't feel like the mortgage interest should be singled out in the broader context of overall itemized deductions. And we'd be happy to engage in that conversation. And at a certain point in the Senate last time, as we were looking at things, we were talking about a broader sort of look at itemized deductions in general. It's, you know, we take it a little personally, though, when our particular one that benefits home ownership is come after.
And this, Mr. Chair, to follow up as well, we've talked about this within the National Home Builders world. Is $1 million the right number? Should it be a lower one? And of course, if you're looking at it from a national perspective, you have some parts of the country that,
right,
that where $1 million of interest is not a starter home, but it's not the next home you buy in the Bay Area. That said, I've been involved this session alone in four different conversations, five counting this one, where additional money is needed, there isn't an obvious source for it, and that you could make a case in terms of nexus and policy relationship to the mortgage interest deduction, which is why I think that has to happen in a comprehensive discussion. If we're going to lower the cap down to a different number and free up some room in the deduction in the state budget from the deduction, it ought to be done thoughtfully, not just an idea that comes up and that's a good one, let's do it, because there may maybe another idea on affordable housing or on career technical education or that makes as much or more sense. And like I say, student loan debt is a critical one. I'm not sure I see as close a nexus for this. If you were asking me to start bidding against myself on the record, I'll probably decline. But hypothetically, there may be other stuff out there that needs to be paid for which the mortgage interest deduction and reduction would be a much closer nexus than this one, which doesn't mean that student loan debt ought not to be talked about, but it ought to be talked about in that broader conversation as part of a broader tax reform.
Yep. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. I'm really proud of the work that this committee is doing and in the testimony we just received. You know, we're trying to focus on bringing down the cost of education. That cost of education is coming from within the education community. I mean, look at it. You know, we talk about education increasing costs. We look at health care. It's coming from in those industries. And if we don't hold that down, no matter what we go out and tax, it's going to keep going up. And we do that by, I think, by things that we're talking about, you know, open or free books or $10,000 degrees. That's what we're doing to try to put some competition within the education community to bring down the cost.
I appreciate the point, Representative Wisner. I think there is also the ongoing disinvestment the state is making, but I hear you as well. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's, you know, it's a question that's more probably apt for Revenue Committee or something, but, Sean, how long has the $1 million cap on mortgage interest deduction been in place? Are there any adjustments that are in that formula, or has it just been $1 million for the last however many years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I know that the mortgage interest deduction itself has been in the code since its inception. Mm-hmm. I don't know when that limit came in, but we could look that up.
Just curious.
Yeah. My guess is probably around the 86 Tax Act, since that's the last time that Congress did any significant work.
Inflation
and
real estate since that time.
Yeah.
And to your point, I did think it was a really good one to note the large variation in different parts of the country and what that effect has elsewhere. Representative Gagus, did I see you?
No.
Seeing attention? Okay. 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 Looking up and down. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. You appreciate it. Next on our list, Susie Rice, Emma Calloway, and Caleb Hayes, please.
Charitable contributions are capped.
Who's first?
I'll start.
Okay.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3342. My name is Susie Rice, and I am a nurse and graduate student at OHSU in Portland. I'm a member of the Oregon Nurses Association, and I'm also serving in a government relations leadership with the ONA. I work in an emergency general surgery and trauma floor, at OHSU, and getting my master's in nursing education. This bill, I'm here this morning in support of this bill because of what it represents, which is a more economically stable future for Oregon and Oregon's youth. I'm the holder of two bachelor's degrees and $93,000 in debt. That's not counting the debt, obviously, that I am accruing in the acquisition of my master's degree. My interest rate is 7.25%, which was awarded to me after I consolidated my two federal loans. It was originally 9%. I have a minimum monthly payment of $1,000, again, which I appealed for that to be lower because the original was $1,200, which I simply couldn't afford. The reason I have such a high monthly payment is not only because of this large debt that I have, but it's because I make a good wage as a nurse, and I love my job. But a good wage is not the usual for people my age. Nursing is a specialty career, and it's a profession that requires a specific educational course and continuing education if you want to go beyond entry level, which for us is bedside nursing. That's entry level, which you require a bachelor's degree as of 2018, actually, in Oregon to be in an acute care setting in the hospital. So if you want to advance your career, you need a master's degree, which is precisely why I'm getting one. My fiance is a teacher, and I make almost 2.5 times what he makes. He has a $45,000 student loan and a minimum monthly payment of $600. So some months We have trouble making ends meet still. We would love to buy a home. We'd love to have a family in the next couple of years, but instead we're choosing to invest in our retirement because if we don't have a stable future, we can't provide one for our kids. And, of course, we have to pay our student loans. We're also putting off getting married in a traditional ceremony and doing the courthouse because it's cheaper. I'm telling you these personal facts because it's the reality for me, and it's tough to swallow, and it's the reality for my generation. Collectively, my generation, like I said, we're all putting off marriage, really. We can't invest in the home. We can't afford a family. And I feel lucky that I have health insurance because a lot of people my age don't have health insurance after 26 because they took a low-paying job right out of college because they either couldn't afford to get the advanced degree they need to get the job in their field, or they simply couldn't find a position available in their field. And the low-wage job doesn't offer them health care. So all of these realities are just disastrous from a personal standpoint, from an economic standpoint, and for the future of Oregon and our country. And I realize with student loan debt and the soaring cost of higher education that we're playing game of inches, but when it comes to decreasing that and sort of fixing the problem of student loan debt, it's a step in the right direction, this House Bill 3342. And I want to reiterate my support for it because it will provide some financial relief for those of us struggling with what feels like an insurmountable problem. Recent graduates, including myself, I've been a nurse for 4 years. We want to be productive members of society. We want to invest in the economy, but we need the opportunity to be given. We need the opportunity to do so. I'd like to thank the committee for listening to me. I'm quite tired from staying up, studying for finals, but I wouldn't miss this for the world, and I wouldn't change staying up till 2 in the morning studying for finals. So I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. We might ask you to stick around a couple more minutes in case we have questions after we hear from
Absolutely.
The others. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Emma Calloway. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Association. Representative Reed and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House Bill 3342 this morning. I'm here because the Oregon Student Association wholeheartedly supports this bill, and we wish that more students could be here, but Wednesday of finals week is a really difficult time to bring students to the Capitol. I'm also here, though, because I have a personal story with my own student loan debt that I think is important to this bill. I attended the University of Oregon, absolutely loved my experience there, wouldn't have traded it for the world, came out with $25,000 in student loan debt, and I make on average about $30,000 a year as the executive director of a nonprofit. Wouldn't change that opportunity either. It absolutely fits the business degree that I received. But that means that I pay a little over 10% of my income into student loan debt, which means that I don't qualify for any of the first home buyer grants in the state of Oregon. I don't qualify for any housing loans. And it would be a relatively risky endeavor for me to consider being a first time home buyer as an unmarried woman living in Oregon. I also have foregone getting a graduate degree, which is a dream of mine. There's nobody in my family with a graduate degree, and that would be a wonderful opportunity, but taking out on average $100,000 in student loans for the degree that I wish to receive is not a good use of my time or my resources, especially since it's very difficult at this point to pay for health insurance as well as save for retirement. Most jobs making under $30,000 don't contribute to a 401k, and so we have to do that out of what is considered disposable income within the banking market, and I would not say that retirement is a type of disposable income. Regardless, this bill helps the economy in Oregon. It helps people of my generation. It helps the students that I represent through the Oregon Student Association. And it would be a game of inches in some way, but it absolutely would be an opportunity to be able to have a tax deduction that then we could put forward towards retirement or continue to save for a future debt load. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to take any questions about my own story or about the students that I work with, but we ask you to support House Bill 3342.
Thanks, Ms. Calloway. Mr. Hayes.
Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name's Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon, as well as COMP Northwest, the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific Northwest, the DO School in Lebanon. And I'm here in support of House Bill 3342. I should have gone first. I know it's a mistake to follow Emma. testimony. We think this is a good bill, as is. However, we would greatly appreciate an amendment that would allow primary care physicians to take advantage of the state-level deduction. In the current bill, the income caps, which are married to federal statutes, would only allow resident DOs to take advantage of the tax deduction. We would like to see this privilege extended to primary care physicians who frequently come out of medical school with significant debt loads, frequently upwards of $500,000. We've been working with Representative Rayfield's office to explore potential amendments that would achieve this goal, and we appreciate their willingness to do that with us. Again, whether amended to allow primary care physicians to take advantage of the credit or not, we support House Bill 3342 and urge you to join us in doing so. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for any of these panelists? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Em, I appreciate you being here and you're hearing your story. My question would be, would OSA also support this measure if it would be looking at, as was suggested earlier today, perhaps you looking at charitable deductions as the source of the revenue, if you will, or ability to offset the cost of these forgiveness of student loan debt?
Representative Reed and Representative Johnson, can you explain again what a shareable deduction is?
Charitable
deduction.
Yeah, putting caps on charitable deductions. So offsetting the cost of this, i.e. to try to make it revenue neutral.
I understand. I believe that the Oregon Student Association would be open to learning more about that.
Great, thank you.
The question is Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Just have a quick question on it, and I'm not sure this is particularly pertaining to the bill, but it does pertain to charitable contributions. My understanding is that there are caps on charitable contributions of 30% to private foundations and 50% if it's a church or something like that. Is that not in play in Oregon?
I am not sure I understand. 30% of what?
Of your gross income.
Okay.
Of your taxable income.
I'm not certain of that. That's easily something we can check on. I'm not certain of that.
According to experience and the IRS, it is capped at that.
IRS, you said at the state level, right?
So the question on the federal level, my question is, does that also apply to the state? I don't know the answer.
Now I think I understand your question. I don't think there's an additional cap. So I think we would be subject to the IRS cap, but I don't think there is a lower cap. So we can check on that, on the state implications of that, and get back to you. But I think we were just subject to the federal cap.
All right. So my point of clarification is that there are caps on charitable contributions already.
I think that's right, and I think the question, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, Representative Johnson, but I think what Representative Johnson is asking is whether we would consider an additional state-level cap as an alternative means. Is that a fair characterization?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming. Before we close out, Representative Rayfield, do you want any last words on your bill? Come forward if you do, please.
The only thing that I would, and again, this is Dan Rayfield, representative from House District 16. The only thing that I noted that I forgot to mention is under the federal current deduction, it doesn't double when you're married. So, and that was what was brought up in some of the testimony a little bit earlier. So if you have $40,000 of debt, and then you marry somebody with the average amount of debt coming out, you are still capped at the $2,500. And so this bill actually aims to help folks in that position as well.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Rayfield now that he's back?
Just one.
Representative Reardon.
You may have said this, but if I move here from another state, I have student loan debt. I would also be qualified to accept the additional benefits of this bill.
And Chair Representative Reardon, yes, that is the case.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, for bringing the bill. Thanks for a good discussion. We will close the hearing on 3342 unless there's anyone else in the room who'd like to testify on it. I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3342. Victoria, that completes our agenda for today.
Oh,
anything
nice job.
Else we need to carry over? Anything else? Okay. So we will see you on Friday at 8 o'clock. Perhaps we'll get done early. Thank you. We're adjourned. Keep trying.
That was...
Keep trying.